Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for joining us. Video game consoles have come under increased scrutiny following reports that terrorists may have used PlayStation 4 to plan deadly attacks in Paris earlier this month. Dakota State University professor Ashley Podorodsky has been researching the criminal potential of non-traditional communication devices for years. She joins us today to talk about how terrorists and criminals use gaming platforms and how all this affects our safety and our civil liberties. Ashley Podorodsky, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, thank you.
Give us an idea of what today's video game consoles can do. We've come a long way since the Atari, haven't we?
We have come a very long way. I think of the original Nintendo when I think of video game consoles. But my research partners and I, Cindy Casey from Philadelphia and Rob DeVideo from Philadelphia as well, what we've been working on for quite a while is the knowing that video game consoles have come a long ways from our original devices. You know, if you wanted to play a game and you wanted to play against someone, you might have some emulator that you're playing against. But right now, when you connect to a video game console, it's sometimes more powerful than a computer. Anything that you do on a computer, you can do on a video game console. So you can send emails, you can open up a share drive and send communication. You're able to send files, receive files, have encrypted communication as well. And so with these devices becoming pretty much a communication hub for a lot of people, forensic investigators need a way to investigate them. And that's the problem that we're coming across, is that investigators want to get information off the devices, but they don't really have a good way of doing that.
Sure. Let's talk about how criminals and terrorists are using the devices. And first, why would they use an Xbox 360 or a PlayStation 4 rather than, say, a computer or a cell phone to communicate with one another?
Because the reason that they're using devices like this is because it's harder for people to investigate them, or they don't necessarily see them as a device that could potentially hold information for their investigation. So when you're looking at a situation where a person is using a computer, we have very time-tested automated responses to investigate that computer, to figure out who they were communicating, what they did, what time, date, time that they did that communication. We understand that. But when it comes to a gaming console, it's completely night and day different. The hardware might look similar in terms of the hard drive, but actually identifying that information and analyzing that information is very challenging.
So it's partially hard to investigate, and then partially it's just flying under the radar a little bit, that people aren't thinking of them in that way?
Absolutely. So they look at them as an entertainment device, not a communication device.
And how many of these devices are out there worldwide?
Well, I mean, there's millions of
millions,
these.
Right. So it's not a small number of devices we're talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely not.
So help us understand this notion of hiding messages in plain sight. What is steganography? How is it different than cryptography?
Well, steganography is a process of hiding information and you don't know it's there. With cryptography, you know that it's there, you just can't read it. And so hiding in plain sight, so what you do is you can take a message and actually embed it inside of another file. So if you go way back, thousands of years, you know, they used to shave people's head, put a message on the head, let the hair grow back, and then the person would go and they'd, you know, transport the message. So the message is there, it's hiding in plain sight. And so that's the difference that when it comes to encryption or cryptography, because you can see that communication, you just can't understand that communication. But with steganography, you can take a picture and embed a Word document, for example, that has instructions or a message, and unless you know that that file is there, you're not going to be analyzing it.
And so when you look at that picture, you pull it up on your screen, it looks the exact same as the other picture. So how would you know that there was something hidden in there? How would a forensic investigator know to even look at that picture?
You don't. Unless you had two messages where you're able to compare the original message with a carrier message and know that there's some differences in terms of size, you wouldn't know that there's anything there.
So all this, the process of doing it and embedding these things and replacing things sounds fairly complex. Does a criminal need an IT degree to figure out how to do this, or is this open source material?
open source free applications that you can download, and it does it for you.
So
you select your carrier message, you select your carrier image, you select the message you want to embed, and it does it for you.
And it does it for you. Same thing with video, too, or just still images?
Absolutely.
And audio?
Absolutely. Correct.
All of those. So I'm wondering, talk a little more about how challenging it is to find and analyze these messages for law enforcement or intelligence agencies. Is it done by a computer algorithm? Are there human analysts involved?
It really is a very involved, tedious process if you're going to be looking for something with steganography, because you have to have the assumption or the knowledge that there is something there, because otherwise there's millions of files on a system, and any file could be a carrier image or a file for another message. And it does take someone knowing that there's something there in order to investigate it. You don't include steganography in a random computer forensic investigation, in other words.
So there's a lot of talk right now about the attacks in France, rightfully so. Take us back for a minute, though, to New York City and the attacks on September 11th. Is there any evidence that terrorists used gaming consoles to plan and execute attacks on American soil?
After 9/11, that's where we saw a lot of steganography communication, because there was some chatter that they were using embedded messages in order to transmit messages. Whether that was proved is something else. But I know that in terms of organized crime, that gaming consoles have been used quite extensively just because of the fact that they do fly under the radar. Unfortunately, in child endangerment cases, for example, you see a lot of gaming consoles that are involved, because parole officers, for example, might not necessarily view a gaming console as a computer. And so when you drug trafficking, money laundering, those types of cases have been using gaming consoles for a very long time.
So how tuned in are local law enforcement officers to the use of these consoles? And do you work with them on forensic research?
A lot of the cases that I've done with gaming consoles have been national cases and international cases that have ranged, you know, from very serious crimes, you know, to not serious crimes. But when it comes to gaming consoles, no region is really immune to the use of them within crimes that are being committed.
Do you work with law enforcement agencies yourself? Do they hire you as an expert?
Yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yep, I do consulting with them, yes.
Okay. In reading the paper that you provided us, it was interesting how simple the use of linguistic steganography could be. Without getting too technical, tell us about how language clues can be inserted in a video game trailer, for example.
Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at gaming consoles and really the world that we're in, everything it has a very international flair. And there are times that just a different language could appear as something that just using another language, it's security by obscurity, in other words, that you can use a different language in order to help hide a message that you're using. And so one of the things that we did is there's a graffiti wall in a game trailer. And so we put information on that trailer in a different language, and, you know, you can hide things very simply there. So really the possibilities are endless. But when it comes to devices like this, unless you know what you're looking for, things can really just go under the radar.
It seems like in your paper, when you talked about the use of that language, though, that the CIA, the NSA, FBI would have had a lot of experience with foreign language and using that in detecting espionage, but that's not necessarily the case. They have been caught unawares with the use of a language other than English. Is that possible?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we did look at from a linguistic perspective was how we could use different languages and different approaches in order to see if we're able to hide information and see if something does go unnoticed. And so that's another area within this research.
So you're actually doing this yourself to find out how the criminals are thinking and what's possible. So you're kind of going out and creating this information and then using that to present to other researchers and officials? How does that work?
Right. So what Cindy, Rob, and I have been working on is identifying information and looking how we can extract that so it can be analyzed. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes to these devices, we don't really know what information is available. And so in a traditional computer forensic case, they want to see who they're communicating with, what kind of messages they've sent, when they've sent them, the contents of those messages. And they want to see that same exact information from a gaming console. So we wanted to see what kind of information or data is available for us to analyze. Where is it stored? How can we identify it? Once we identify it, how do we extract it so that way we keep the integrity of the data in check? And once we do that, how can we report on it so that way they can use that in an active investigation? So we did a lot of, and I'm going to use this term loosely, but reverse engineering of the information. So we would go through and generate traffic, knowing the different actions that we did, and try and find that traffic on the gaming console so that way we can map that data. So we have a few other papers just that are written only on the mapping of investigative data on the gaming console. So we'd go through and create traffic, know what we were looking for, and then try and find that traffic and map it so that way we can extract it and analyze it. And then we'd go through on different devices and replicate that. So we wanted to see, knowing where it was stored, see if we can find that on another device, and then just have that repeatability in our process.
How did you first get interested in this? How long have you been in looking at these non-traditional devices?
So about 6 years I've been working on this area. So it was just, I had been in the computer forensic field for a while, and I wanted to pick a device that I felt I could have an impact in. And every research paper that we've written a corresponding white paper for law enforcement community that really strips out the research behind it and just gives it the practitioner's approach. So that way they can take our paper and use it in investigations.
And how often are these devices then updated? And do you have to start from scratch when a company releases a new product?
You do, absolutely.
Do you stand in line at 1 o'clock in the morning to get one? And then
I do not. Oh, okay. I do not do that. But we do get them when they come out. So the Xbox One, we've been working on that. That's based on a totally different file operating system than the Xbox 360, for example. So the 360 was based on FATX, and the Xbox One is actually NTFS. And so there's a different approach that we'd have to use for those devices. So every time there is a new update, we have to be able to figure out where data is located on that device and analyze that device as well. But, I mean, then you start throwing in the cloud and remote storage and identifying if data is stored locally or remotely. You know, that's another complex area as well.
I want to make sure we get to your recommendations. How can investigators use these emerging devices to prevent criminal activity and keep the public safe? Is that even possible? Is prevention in the conversation here?
Well, you know, forensics is a response-based field. And so we look at something that happens and then we have to respond to it. So incident response houses forensics. So in terms of stopping the criminal activities that occur on the devices, that really is a separate conversation opposed to the investigative work that we've been doing.
How about general recommendations for once a device is confiscated in an investigation?
So when it comes to devices being analyzed, we have to make sure that we don't alter anything. Because if we go through and we start changing date, time information, the integrity of the device can really throw in question the integrity of the investigation. And so that's where we have to take a look at. A lot of the work that I do forensically could be at businesses or it could be civil, criminal, but for the gaming council, it's almost exclusively criminal investigations. So when you're talking about criminal, you have to keep in mind Fourth Amendment considerations and then also the integrity of the device.
Sure. Is there one type of crime that seems to be more prevalent in this
There's
arena?
A lot of money laundering.
A lot of
Absolutely.
Money laundering.
There's a lot of money laundering that occurs on these devices. We have a convergence of physical game denominations and in-world currencies that creates a problem. So you can take money, U.S. dollars, and convert it to Bitcoin, for example, and then you can use Bitcoin to make a purchase on your device, and then that person can take the Bitcoin and convert it to U.S. dollar. So on and so forth. So when you look at virtual currencies and virtual goods and the value that they have for physical world denomination, there is a lot of money laundering that occurs.
Interesting. Should gamers be concerned about their devices? Should they be concerned about surveillance? Should they be concerned about what's being stored on them? Dr. Podorotsky, are you still with us?
I am. I'm okay. Hearing, there we go.
You got a little, yeah. So the question I'm wondering about is if you're a consumer and you own one of these, it's already in your home, you're looking at it a little differently today maybe. Should you be concerned? Are there ways you can protect your civil liberties, your Fourth Amendment, what's on there?
So from a consumer standpoint, one thing is identity theft that you should be concerned with, just like anything that you're using. Instead of putting a straight credit card number on a gaming console to make purchases, you can use a preloaded card, for example. That's the biggest concern that I have for the average consumer, is making sure that you protect your personal identifying information and your identity as well.
And what do parents need to know to understand what's in their living room and how it might be used?
Absolutely. Parents need to understand that this device that they look at for entertainment opens the door to anyone around the world that's using a similar device. And so, you know, monitoring what your kids are doing, what they're saying, who they're talking with, if they're sharing any information, you know, keep all of that active. And the best thing for parents is to not put their credit card number straight on the machine. You can get a preloaded Microsoft card, for example, if you're using the game in Xbox Live, and you can use that to make purchases, so that way you don't have to put your own personal information in jeopardy.
What are the companies doing, Sony and Microsoft? Do they have a concern? Are they working with government agencies and law enforcement? Are they kind of staying out of it? What is their responsibility here, and how are they responding to that?
The game manufacturers, they are working with law enforcement when there is a request. They do work with, you know, researchers such as myself and others when it comes to some of this work. But they also have a vested interest in keeping some of their proprietary information private because it's a competitive advantage for them. And so we're never given all the pieces that we need. So, you know, there just has to be some communication between gaming manufacturers and law enforcement in order to handle requests when they are needed. But they are doing a pretty good job when it comes to that.
We just have about 30 seconds left. I wanted to shift gears so that you had a chance to talk about how important it is for young women and girls to explore careers in cybersecurity. Do you want to talk about your camp for a second?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we have at Dakota State is Gen Cyber Girls. It is a camp for 7th through 9th grade girls, and it's a free camp. It's going to be June 20th through 24th. And you can sign up at gencybergirls.camp. And that's gencyber.girls.camp. And it's a completely free week-long event where the girls learn the basics of programming, networking, and security. Okay. And they'll get to talk with industry leaders and meet other girls from around the country that are interested in this field.
Dr. Podorotsky, thank you for sharing your expertise with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Ashley Podorotsky is co-author of The Xbox 360 and Steganography, How Criminals and Terrorists Could Be Going Dark. She presented this paper in 2012 at the Conference on Digital Forensic Security and Law, remains relevant today. She joined us from the campus of Dakota State University in Madison.